I remember riding in an Uber kind of pre-pandemic. And I was riding in there, and the driver had the radio on. And on the radio was this man talking about crystals and the healing power of crystals. If you shine the light, you can get rid of all these different ailments, and it can bring these different things into your life. And he was talking about it. And then this British guy came on who was articulate and intelligent, and he started talking about a friend of his that had been healed by these crystals, and he was expressing all these things. And the British guy said that he was positively baffled that more people weren't enthusiastic about this stuff. And I kind of sat there, and the driver's like, "What do you think?" I'm like, "Well," and I'm like, "Whatever." And I get out of the car because we're at the location. I'm ready to kind of get out and move on from that whole experience and that whole radio program and the driver and everything else. And now I have to admit, on a day like Easter, on a day where many people will come to church, many people might attend the online style service. Maybe a family member or a friend has invited you, and I think for some of you, that whole experience of me sitting in a car is somewhat what it feels like maybe for you to be here today. Like, you may not care how nice I am or seem, or relatively normal things actually seem, but we're talking about the life and death of a first century Middle Eastern peasant. Sure, he has some nice things to say, but they sound like things that other people have said in larger religious pantheon, and a lot of what he taught seems similar to some other teachers. And to be completely honest, like, some of their groups seem way more chill or significantly woke than some of these church groups. And so it doesn't matter if you dress it up with some philosophy and quotes and maybe some cultural anthropology. You expect me to believe this guy wasn't just a good teacher, but God in human form, that he demonstrated in some authoritative sense that he knew what life was truly like, and his death has a bearing on my life 2,000 years later, and he didn't just die, but he came back to life, and those who trust in him, like, are so profoundly reformed from within that they join into the redemption of the whole world. That's the gist of it, right? Okay, like, how long is this gonna last? Can we get through this? And I want to acknowledge, like, to a number of you all, even streaming this, that might be how you even feel. Maybe you're sitting on the couch with a friend or a spouse or something else where it's okay, I'll jump through this hoop. And I want to say, welcome. I understand how you feel. I understand some of the struggles with some of these things around Easter. But I also want to encourage you that you are surrounded, that you are probably joined in with, that you are joining online with a community of people who have had a personal encounter with the events that I just spoke about, and they've been profoundly reformed from within. Their life has been an inexplicable response to the crazy set of events, and right now they're sitting there with hearts throbbing with great gratitude today. And to many of you all, I just want to say happy Easter to you. He is risen. And hopefully you followed along and said, "He is risen indeed at home." But I want to ask a question. And this kind of goes for all of us. Is what we are listening to true enough to take us where we want to go? And when I say true, I don't mean sort of the exclusivist claim to it. I kind of mean it in a more ancient sense, almost like shooting an arrow. And when you shoot it and it goes to where it wants to go, you say that the aim is true. The arrow is proven true by going in the direction that it was meant to go in. Is what you are allowing to shape your life proving true as you use it? Is it proving that? Is it taking you from where to where you're aiming to go? Do the things that shape you, does it know enough about humanity and yourself to help you flourish? Does it love you, or does it want to control you? Is it concerned about your deepest needs, or is it selling you something? Or is it reforming and shaping you into the best version of yourself, or stirring up your own selfishness? Is it taking the full scope of reality into account, or just ignoring certain parts of it? Because I'll tell you what, this past year of 2020, I think exposed a lot. If I were to sit down with you in 2019 and say, "Hey, next year, We're going to have close to 3 million deaths from a global pandemic. We're going to shut down countries and economies wholesale, like the streets of New York and Beijing and Paris. And like, they're going to be deserted. Many are going to lose their jobs. Some young adults are going to be moving back into their parents in droves. Not only that, like, most jobs are going to be digitized. Schools are going to be digitized. In addition to that, there's going to be protests worldwide around race and injustice. There's going to be protests around election results. There's going to be people all up in arms about wearing a piece of fabric over their face. And for some reason, a lot of Americans are going to sit down and watch a crazy show about a guy who's really into tigers. And so all of that is going to happen in 2020. And would you believe me? No, of course not. None of us had any bearing that that would be a future reality to us. And it's interesting, the more and more of us that get vaccinated, I think there's some semblance of normalcy starting to arise. And I hear phrases like, oh, I can't wait to go back to how things were. And I've got news to you. I don't know if it will. And what I mean, I'm not talking about sort of relation to hygiene products. I'm not talking about face masks and hand cleaning and all that kind of stuff, though washing your hands is always good. But this past year tended to accelerate, I think, trends that are already happening. Trends that kind of have thrown cracks into the question of what do you believe in and what is true. I think there was a fire that was already burning towards ideas like moral relativism that 2020 just poured gasoline on. The idea that everyone can self-define their own version of right and wrong, good and evil, that has just continued to steamroll. There was a fire already burning for this digital revolution, and 2020 burned gasoline on it, or threw gasoline on it. We were already checking into our phones close to 200 times a day before the pandemic, but now we're glued to screens for work, for entertainment, and the phones are still in our pockets, and it's only getting worse. There's a fire already burning towards political polarization, and 2020 just poured more gasoline on that. You would think a national crisis would actually pull us together, and it did have that effect in something like 9/11, but this one caused a further rift, partnered with a digital world that algorithmically is pulling you further apart and creating echo chambers for yourself. There was a fire already burning in people's overall exhaustion and anxiety, and 2020 poured gasoline on it. Americans are more anxious now than ever in their history. There's a more overall feeling of being exhausted as we're pulled in multiple directions as the digital revolution makes us tethered to our phones and our jobs. And not only that, but now we're helping kids be educated at home and all these other things. There was a fire already burning towards injustice, and 2020 poured gasoline on that. The year involved an increase in violence against Asian Americans, a greater focus on violence in the African American community, and while many in the lower middle class people struggled and moved downwards economically, there was a $1 trillion growth in the wealthiest, particularly in this country. There's a fire burning towards ideology and individualism. 2020 poured gasoline on that. And we continue to be driven by these untested ideologies that seem subtle about freedom and liberty, but all the undergirding effects seem to be damaging to us. This Western individualism that we keep fighting for. And in the midst of a challenging of unknown cultures and worldviews, all these things, the suffering that many have experienced that we're sort of coming out of, and many of us are sort of starting into these narrative of hopes of like, I can't wait for things to get better. I can't wait for things to go back to how they were. I think at this moment is when the resurrection becomes the most important. Like, we still have the lingering effects of 2020. There's still some things that are struggles and not right. There's all the things that were poured on and accelerated because of 2020, and we're at this transition hopeful moment. And what does the resurrection of Jesus have to do with that? It's amazing because someone like one of Jesus' disciples in Peter connects the dots, I think, for us. Because you have Peter. You have Peter who has walked with Jesus. He was a disciple following around Jesus all throughout Israel. He got to learn from Jesus. He got to experience Jesus. He saw the highs and the lows. He had moments of triumph and moments of Jesus calling him Satan. He had all of these in his life. And not only that, but leading up to Jesus' death, he even had a denial of Jesus, a public denial of Jesus. But then he also encountered an empty tomb. Of all people, to be the one to run to that tomb, it's Peter, and he sees it, and he knows that this tomb is empty, and he ultimately, through the gospel writer John, we find out that Peter has this encounter with Jesus himself, and is restored, and ultimately sets off to be this church planter into the Mediterranean world. And we'll pick up today in a letter that that Peter is writing to one of those churches. Peter, who has had these experiences, is writing to a church in what is modern-day Turkey that is struggling, that is experiencing various forms of suffering and persecution for what they believe, and not because they were so fighting against everybody. The early Christians were people that just said, look, we're not going to pledge allegiance to Caesar and Rome, or we're not going to go continue to worship the gods of Greece and do all the sort of pagan festivities and businesses that are all tied into that. We want to gather as a community. We want to tell you about Jesus. And we just want to go ahead and do that. We're going to proclaim this resurrection and worship him. And yet they were peculiar to this Greek and Roman world and were sometimes pushed back against. And so Peter is writing to this group that is peculiar, that is suffering, that is in this transition, that has this idea of hope and future, but at the same time is wrestling with the moment. And what he does to start how to talk to them is go immediately to the resurrection. He goes immediately to hope. To this church that is suffering, the first thing he does is actually point back 20 years before to this empty tomb and to the risen Jesus. And he makes clear that that's where their heart need to be. So let's go to 1 Peter 1, starting at verse 3. Blessed be to God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So this resurrection was so momentous. It wasn't just an odd thing to happen to Peter. Like, oh, like, I guess some people come back to life. Like, that hasn't happened yet, but that's pretty cool. No, the conclusion for Peter was, hold on, this changes everything. Jesus was human and now existed in this unique way, and he was sometimes recognized by the people that saw him after his death, and sometimes he was otherworldly and not recognizable. And for Peter, this changed everything. It meant this world was different than he had thought, that God has plans that are bigger than he thought. The future of humanity is defined what he saw, that death does not have the final verdict on the story. And the event has a shaping significance to Peter. He calls it a living hope, that it gives followers of Jesus this dynamic, alive hope to it. That's eternally present. It's not just a past tense thing. It's not just a future thing. It is a living hope right now, with a capacity to change and transform you. It does something to you. It turns you into this new kind of human. That's why it's sort of the only way to describe it here is how Peter does. It's like, oh, like, it's almost like somebody that's been born a second time. The resurrection has made you such a different human. It's almost like you get born again. And I know that language has some baggage, but it's biblical language and that we are born again. And Peter is writing about something that it will take like something like psychology 1,850 years to finally catch up with. This lesson learned about what hope does for individuals, how it transforms people. The lesson is expressed quite well by someone like Viktor Frankl. I've spoken about him before, but he wrote, he was in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany, and he wrote about his experience. And he was a scientist. He liked research. He liked psychology. And he would be in these concentration camps and watch different people's struggle in the midst of the concentration camps. And he noticed that what happened in those camps was transitions and upheavals in life that are all condensed into a very short period of time. Transitions that most of us go through at some point in our lives, but are all condensed into a very short time frame, where people are taken away from their homes or their roots. People are losing loved ones. They're losing friends. They're losing status that came with something like a career. They're losing freedom of movement. They're losing their health. Often many of us experience those things over a lifetime, but these are all condensed into a very short time frame for those that were brought into the concentration camps. And Frankl watched how different people dealt with this. He observed that those who were able to sort of survive and maintain any form of a semblance of health and were ultimately brought out of the camps and had a semblance of a regular life afterwards were people that saw a greater meaning and purpose and hope in their trajectory and in their situation. There were those who were hopeless and became bitter and violent and angry, They would die quicker. Those who were apathetic and numb, their psychology accelerated their demise. And there were some that were super practical about hope, like, hey, one day it's going to get better. One day it's going to get better. And we're going to get out of here. And maybe just next month or next year. And many of the people were good and excited for a bit, but it usually took their toll. But the last group, those who had their hope that transcended their circumstances, who made it out and carried, they carried out some form of normalcy in their lives. It was that group, a hope that could not be touched by their captors, and it could may not be affected by their situation. It's almost as if Frankl had his thumb on something we observe about humanity and how we are actually created that Peter actually really unpacks for us. A hope from an empty tomb and risen Jesus that is absolutely able to transform your life in a way that's not contingent upon your circumstances. How? How do I have access to that hope? For many of us, maybe we even struggle with the idea of like, oh yeah, today I have living hope and a new humanity for myself. But Peter explores this idea. And I think it plays into two things, not denying our circumstances, but also embracing it. Verse 4. So we have this living hope, and it's to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. So Peter moves into a bit of a, almost like a financial metaphor here to talk about sort of this human's drive to survive, the sort of hope that we have this big stockpile of cash in some ways in the bank, this inheritance, and it cannot be touched by anyone or anything. There's no life circumstances that are going to affect this. It's kept in heaven for us. It doesn't necessarily mean for Peter that it's some future thing that you need to grab onto that you'll just get necessarily one day, though there's some of that in there. It simply is implying that God is the keeper of the inheritance. It is steadfast. It is there. No one can take the truth of Easter away from you. So this inheritance, it won't change, but you will change by it. And he says this, in this you rejoice. That inheritance, that money in the bank, does it bring about joy? Yes, of course. There's a posture of joy that comes from it. So though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. And so Peter points out the obvious. Yes, there's joy in this inheritance, but life is difficult too. There's grieving. There's various trials. 2020 was a list of a whole lot of various trials for many of us. And for Peter, as he's saying, I hold on to this living hope and go through daily life, there's going to be trials. Your posture, yes, rejoicing, joy, even by verse 8, an inexpressible and glorious joy, but there's grief too. And to be clear, I don't think Peter is just trying to give us platitudes here. Like if you had a friend who just lost so much through a tragedy, they lost someone close to them, whatever it is, and you call them up and you're asking them like, hey, like, how are you doing? What's going on? And they're like, I'm doing great. Things have never been better. You would be like, okay, that person's insane and there's something wrong and we need to check in on them really quick. That's just not, I don't think that's what Peter's after. I don't think Peter's trying to just teach them to turn their frown upside down here. It's not just grin and bear it, chin up, Christian, because I think there's some theology that gets taught in that way. But we also see what is true in Jesus' life. When Jesus is facing grief and anguish, knowing the cross is standing before him, knowing that he's going to be abandoned by his friends, he's going to be denied by Peter in a moment, he does not get into the garden and laugh it off and go, you know what, God, you're still good, and I love you, and this is going to be awesome. He's overwhelmed by grief. He seems almost at a loss of words that the only thing he can even pray out loud are prayers of lament that he knows from the Psalms. He's so much anguish, he's bleeding over it. And he comes to this moment. And there's finally a moment in the garden where he commits his life and his future into his Father's hands. Knowing that they are working together to do something about the human condition, there's trust and hope. And Jesus stands there and goes, not my will, but yours be done. And I think what Peter's after is this deep choice that is made. Because I trust in the event of the empty tomb and a risen Jesus, that it can unlock this living hope that can't be taken away by anybody. What I choose in the face of suffering is choosing hope, choosing joy. It doesn't mean that it just makes me happy, but it means that the tragedy does not have a final word. 2020 does not have a final word. All these cultural changes we are in do not have the final word. There is resurrection on the other side. And Peter uses a few more metaphors to really express this. When we choose joy through trust and through faith in the resurrection, and we go through pain and loss, here's what he says it might look like. Verse 7, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes through it, is tested by fire. So Peter goes into this whole metalworking analogy, and the whole process is always fascinating. Of at some point, you got to mine the raw materials. You got to go out to a mine and get the metals, whatever they are, these nuggets or veins of metal, and dig them all out of the ground. And then that metal is sent to be, it's mixed with dirt and other rock and other metals. And so you got to take it to somebody that's going to melt it down. And so they subject it to a tremendous amount of heat so that the impurities float to the top, and ultimately it separates the things out, and the intense heat, it like reduces the metal down to its most basic essential state. And you would think it's almost destroying it by putting through such intense fire, but what you are doing is making it possible, the only way possible, to remove everything that does not belong to the metal's essence. Strain it all out. And then you pour it into the mold and you get something so much more pure. And the resurrection of Jesus makes it possible to have this living hope that's so transformative that our experiences of deep pain and loss and grief and all these transitions, that we are to see those things as strange and sometimes as unpleasant as they are, as also a gift that transforms us into a different kind of human. So Peter's kind of mingling all these ideas together. So when careers change, when people in your lives come and go, when their sense of normalcy is stripped away, when all of our places of identity and community are broken down, when those things happen, there's still one more committed to you through it all, whose love and commitment transcends the grave. All of the things in our life offer a weaker sense of hope. Let's keep going, and may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Though you have seen him, you love him. Though you do not see him now, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of our faith, the salvation of our souls. We should notice what Peter does here at the beginning of the section and through on out. He does not say you have this joy because one day you will be resurrected. It's not the focus for Peter. He doesn't say, hey, don't worry about this, you'll come back from the grave. He says, don't worry about this because Jesus came back from the grave. My ultimate hope is not my own personal destiny, but my hope is something that, hear me, that's still part of it. But my hope is something outside of myself that was done for me. Peter does not base our hope on good wishes and philosophy, on sort of, oh, we'll see it all in heaven one day. His basis is on a historical moment and event, the physical resurrection of Jesus. And why does Jesus' resurrection, well, not my resurrection, why does Jesus' resurrection give me that kind of hope? Because of what happened Friday and Sunday 2,000 years ago. Jesus would sit down with his disciples over a meal and speak about things like bread and wine. He would connect these wealth of stories that had existed for 1,500 years that God was telling through his people, and he would bring them together in his life. The truth is that each of us sin. We are sinners. We have countless ways that we do not trust and honor the very God who created us, going all the way back to the garden. Various ways we do not live how he desired and designed us to live. That is sin. And it marks all of us, this act of treason against the king of the universe. But Jesus says it's good news. Jesus, knowing the darkness of sin and death that plagued every human, knowing the wrath that was due from all that sort of treason against our creator, Jesus spoke to the disciples plainly that he would take that on. And for the joy set before him, he did it. And because the Father so loved the world, he sent his Son to do it. And in paying for our sin, Jesus also showcased this new way to be human as well. This suffering, sacrificial love for God and the well-being of others. So Jesus has called us into and said, you want to flourish in life? Go live that way. And it is true. Jesus loves our world so much that he would take his own suffering death into himself. He would overcome it with his own life, and he became what we are so we can become what he is. And the future of the universe walked out of the tomb on Easter morning. So where is your true hope? What is your faith founded upon? And this past year was unique and upheaval, and it just begs the question. Maybe there's cracks that have been exposed, and maybe some individualism, and people sank into deeper levels of anxiety and loneliness, and those might be telltale signs that what you might be shaped by is outside of Jesus. Or cracked in science and the trust in rational thought all the time. And yes, it's a powerful too, but it is not perfect. People will get sick. People will die. And I hate to tell you, everybody even listening to this, that is included. The shaky foundations of politics, of self-created identities, of routines, of community, of place, of family, of education, all exposed. And hear me, all those things are good things. None of those are wicked in and of themselves, but when something perishable, defilable, and fading takes the place of that which is imperishable, undefiable, and unfading, you short-circuit the whole system that you were created to be. If it is anything but Jesus, you will fail. It's been a learning process for us as a church. It's been a learning process, I think, for a lot of churches over this country. What are we really built upon? Coffee? Donuts? An amazing kids ministry, awesome community groups, certain kind of music, certain kind of justice projects that we're involved in, that we're mobilized around. What happens when all those things are stripped away? Where people can't sit in the row with their friends? Where we can't do hospitality like we normally could? When we have to meet in parking lots and online and other things? When all those things are taken to their bare bones, well, guess what? God has a pretty good experience speaking to those bones and bringing them to life. We are called to be a church centered around what it was always about, and that is Jesus. If church is simply about community, it's an idol. If it's simply about a place to drop off your kids, it's an idol. If it's a certain kind of style of music, and it's an idol. We are putting things before Jesus, and there's such a great moment at this time in our personal faith and our corporate faith to simply go, okay, let's focus and center our lives on Jesus. A community coming together to worship and glorify God, to bow down before him. I don't want to go back to what was. I want to keep coming to what's next in there is this renewed life with Jesus. So the invitation today is around the resurrected Jesus. The Apostle Paul did not say, without the crucifixion, our faith is in vain. In 1 Corinthians 15, he would go on to say, no. He said, the resurrection, our faith is in vain. If we have no resurrection, our faith is in vain. That's a strong assertion to drive towards Sunday almost more than Friday. The resurrection is about what you fundamentally believe is true in the world. What is the truest true? What is the realest real? What is the thing, if you burned away all the dross, would remain? Does love win? Does life end in death? Or is death not really the end? Resurrection is God's affirmation that to those who believe in Jesus, life really does get the last word. The way of generosity really is the best way to live. Forgiveness is worth paying the price for, and love does really win. Resurrection is God's way of saying hope is worth it, and the story can be trusted. And I choose, and I hope you do choose, to be a person of hope. He is not there. He is risen. So we've hopefully encouraged you this week to be ready to take communion again. And it's been a long time probably for many of you. And hopefully you have your elements. If not, maybe find a way to pause this somehow and go get ready and get those things in front of you. And when Jesus sat down with his disciples, on the day he was about to be betrayed and handed over to death, the night before, he took these elements that had been part of Passover celebrations, that had been part of these feasts that the Israel or that the Jews had celebrated for years and years and years. And he took this bread and he broke it. And he said, "This is my body broken for you. Eat. And that we would do that in remembrance of him. And in the same way, he took this cup. And in the cup was sort of the symbolism of blood, of sacrifice. This idea that sin had a wage of death, and he held this cup and he said, this is my blood poured out for you to establish this new covenant. And in so doing, pointing at this moment, saying, look, all those lambs in Passover, all those deaths in the temple, all the ways that God has provided a substitute for you is being fulfilled in me. A perfect substitute. And he says, drink, do this in remembrance of me. And every time we would gather, and if you come in person, we do this weekly now, that we proclaim his death and resurrection until he comes again. And my hope is that you take this moment to just reflect. What is really true? What are all the things you might be shaped by versus the very word of God and the truth about a resurrected Jesus? And may you partake in your communion elements. If you need to kind of pause before the music starts next, feel free to do so. But I'm going to close us in prayer. God, I am so thankful for Easter and what a joy it is. But it's not a joy filled with platitudes and just trying to buck up and be happy, but a joy that is deep and real. That no matter the circumstances in our lives, the storms that some of us find ourselves in, the storms that some of us feel like we're coming out of, no matter what those situations are, that there is a deeper joy. It wasn't as if your disciples suddenly had an easy life after the resurrection. But God, your resurrection gives us a sense of what is true is true. What is the realest real? And may it redefine our lives in such a way that people go, that person seems like a whole new person. They are different than the people of this world. They are distinct. They almost seem supernatural, because that's what you have for us. I pray all this in your name. Amen. Thanks, y'all.